Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Welcome to a series of special episodes in lieu of the College Congress that would have been. In this third episode, we hear from Professor Uday Devgan, founder of the YouTube channel Cataract Coach. He shares his advice for junior cataract surgeons, as well as advice on how to keep up your skills during COVID-19. We then hear from authors of abstracts, which had been accepted for presentation as posters.
I am ready for this meeting to meet all the young ophthalmologists in the UK, but sadly, I won't be making it to Birmingham for this meeting due to the COVID-19 crisis. But I'm really happy that we can share many of those same pearls that we would have talked about in person right here through this podcast.
Thanks, Uday. We were so excited to greet you in Birmingham, but hopefully you can join us next year for an even bigger and better Congress. So, do you have any words of wisdom for trainees who might be worried about a lack of operating in these current times due to COVID-19?
Some of the young surgeons that I work with, particularly those who are finishing their training now, are worried that they're not going to get enough surgical experience during their training program due to the COVID-19 virus issues. Certainly, our clinic volumes have been severely curtailed, and even surgical volume has dropped dramatically, particularly with elective cases such as routine cataract surgery. But I've got good news for you. You are good to go. You remember this, you're a lifelong learner. You're going to learn more in your first couple years of practice than in all the previous years of training combined. I know it sounds unbelievable, but you'll tell me in a few years I was absolutely right. You're going to continue to learn and you'll teach yourself. That's the beauty in what we do. If you watch any of my videos on Cataract Coach, let me tell you, what you see on those videos is not the way I was taught to do surgery 20 years ago. And it's not the way that I taught residents 10 years ago. Things change, things advance. We're constantly progressing. So whatever you do in the future, whether it's retina, cataract, cornea, you can teach yourself any of these procedures, and you can help a lot of patients. So remember that concept. Yes, you did lose out on some surgeries in your training program due to the COVID-19 virus, but it's not going to make a big dent in the big scope of things. Remember, too, that if you're talking about cataract surgery, you probably need at least 1,000 cataracts to be about 50% up the learning curve. So if you did 150 in your training versus 300, it's really not that big of a deal. You're still nowhere close to being half up the curve. So don't worry. Keep your skills sharp. Be prepared to teach yourself and you'll be fine.
That's really good advice. Do you have any specific tips for trainees to help them keep their skills up?
Now, during this downtime, it's important to keep your hands moving. And this can be doing certain surgeries that we're continuing now, even during the virus crisis, ruptured globe surgeries, retina surgeries, urgent glaucoma surgeries. But it can also be from going to the wet lab, practicing suturing. You can use pig eyes or the model eyes. I came into my clinic at the University Hospital one day at 6 a.m, and in the back room, quietly, I had one of my junior residents practicing suturing under the microscope. And I was asked, what are you suturing right there? And he says, oh, it's a tomato. I got it from the cafeteria. I sliced it with a blade and now I'm putting it back together. That's impressive to me. He's keeping his hands wet. He's moving those hands, using both hands, practicing right hand and left hand. Even outside the lab, you can practice using both hands. You can take up hobbies in downtime that require the use of both hands. I, for example, build audio speakers and have taught myself a lot of the woodworking and finishing of these projects, a lot of the electronics as well, and the micro-soldering. If you're a young registrar now and you're worried about not doing enough surgery, head to your wet lab, practice suturing using 10-0 nylon on a pig eye, on a model eye, on a tomato. If you're so lucky that you have surgical simulators as part of your training program, please make use of them. Surgical simulators are good in building up that dexterity. And don't just do things right-handed or with your dominant hand. Switch things up. Use that non-dominant hand as well. In fact, even in your daily life, I certainly hope that the young doctors are using both hands every day. Meaning, if you usually shave your face and brush your teeth with your right hand, start doing it with your left hand. And if it feels very odd or strange, that's a signal to you that you need to practice a whole lot more.
How is COVID-19 affecting your clinical practice? And what changes do you think will come about to the way we practice ophthalmology in the long term as a result?
Last week was my first day back in clinic seeing routine patients after more than 6 or 7 weeks of hiatus due to the COVID-19 virus. My clinic was largely empty due to the weak demand for elective surgical procedures that I do, mainly cataract and refractive surgery. That certainly helped with the required 6 feet of distancing between people, but it sure made the place look empty. If you look at some of the survey results from ophthalmologists around the world, they show the extent of the stress and hardship that all these practices are enduring. Like all ophthalmologists in the USA, the UK, and beyond, our practice is struggling, and we're going to need to permanently change so that we can adapt to these new conditions. For those of us who perform purely elective surgeries like cataract, refractive, or even eyelid cosmetic, the economic hit may be particularly hard compared to subspecialties where care is more urgent, such as retina or glaucoma. Remember, older cataract patients may elect to defer their surgery for months or longer out of fear of becoming sick. And the refractive and cosmetic patients who pay out of pocket for their services, they're often younger and healthier, but they may have more issues with personal finance due to loss of employment. You know, the COVID-19 virus is not going to simply disappear, so we have to deal with it. We've got to use strict precautions for months or maybe even years to come. It may mean a lower volume of patients for in-person visits, longer time between patients to allow for proper disinfection of exam rooms or equipment, and the use of personal protective gear for both medical people and patients. In our surgery center, similar restrictions are limiting the number of surgeries we can do per day. I was previously doing 3 cataracts per hour per operating theater. We're down to maybe 1.5 now. You know, the use of telemedicine is increasing, but it's still limited when it comes to intraocular conditions. So we're doing what our colleagues are doing. We're being cautious and safe, putting patient interests first, and still giving the best care that we know how. We're also seeing the positives of spending more time with family, having a slower pace, and appreciating the beauty of life. There's always going to be a need for ophthalmologists, and we're going to be ready to fill it. So hang in there.
Okay, so let's stop talking about COVID now and move on to what everyone is really interested about. Could you tell us a bit more about Cataract Coach and how it all started?
Yeah, so I've been working with young doctors in training for 20 years. I also run my own private practice. So in my professor duties, it's important to me to be able to teach a young doctor certain techniques. And ophthalmology, of course, being such a visual science, both in obviously what we're doing, but also the way we learn it, it makes it very easy to record videos, edit them, and share techniques that way. So residents have often said, you know, I have a case coming up, an unusual case. How do you recommend I do this? And I'd have to hunt around for a video clip to show them a technique, or I'd draw it out on a piece of paper. But I thought, gosh, there's got to be a better way. And so the idea behind cataractcoach.com was to have a website where I could host all these videos. And then I decided we need to have an edited video, fully narrated, great teaching point every day. And so now, for about the last 540 days, I've posted a new teaching video on cataractcoach.com, never missing a single day. I do host all the videos on YouTube. So if you want to bypass the one-a-day video on Cataract Coach and see what's actually going to be coming in the near future, the next few weeks, you can go to YouTube on my Cataract Coach channel and see all of the videos, because that's where they're hosted. But I think that's the way of the future, is being able to watch these videos on your mobile phone ahead of time and then go to the operating room, and you'll perform better.
Yeah, I mean, I find your videos really useful, but does it not take you a huge amount of time and commitment to make all this? I mean, how long does it take you? How much time do you put into editing and recording all these videos?
Wow, great question. As you know, it's very easy to film the surgery. You just do the procedure and hit record on your microscope recorder. The hard part's getting that video file, editing down, making the text, making a title page, doing a voiceover, finally rendering the video. It is very time consuming. And so you're correct that for you to watch that 5-minute video, I may have put at least an hour into it, if not more. And so it does require a significant chunk of my time, but I think it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, I mean, especially for the thousands of people who watch your videos, I'm sure it all adds up. So, you know, you've posted hundreds of videos with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tips for junior cataract surgeons on how to improve their technique, how to improve their posture, ergonomics, attitude, psychology towards their training. But I was wondering, could you share with us, you know, particularly for the UK-based cataract surgeons and the junior trainees, what would be your top 5 tips?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think I have a lot of wisdom to share in this regard. So if I was going to give my advice to myself 20 years ago, or if I'd give advice to young doctors in training now, I'd say the top 5 things are, number 1, prepare. You've got to prepare for the surgeries ahead of time. If you have an unusual case coming up, like a posterior polar cataract, look it up on YouTube. Look it up on Cataract Coach. On Cataract Coach, I have no less than 10 videos of all different grades of posterior polar cataract. And you'll realize that, wow, the published studies show that it's a very high risk of capsule rupture. And in fact, one of the 10 videos I show, the capsule does rupture. But how do you recover from it? How do you still have a beautiful outcome? So preparing ahead of time is super important. There are a lot of other resources. There are resources like your Slit Lamp Studio channel on YouTube, where you can see ahead of time, here are some of the important findings. We're visual. To see the surgery, to see the slit lamp findings, now we understand the disease and what to look for. So I think it's very important to prepare ahead of time for all these procedures. Read about them. The case you have coming up that's unusual, do some homework. I'm not immune to this. I've recently started doing DMEC, corneal transplantation. You can catch me most nights, the night before the video, the surgery, watching other people's videos and learning their techniques of how to gently unroll that graft. I think second point would be to practice. It's so important to get those hands moving. Now, whether it's in the wet lab and you're working on cadaver eyes, pig eyes, even the simulated plastic model eyes, or using the IC surgical simulator or something similar. Here at UCLA, where I'm a professor, we published a study that showed that among our trainee doctors, if they did the IC protocol ahead of time, it actually gave them a lower complication rate of anterior capsular runout in cataract surgery in their first year of training. So it really made a difference. Now, the surgical simulators are great, but they're not like real surgery. Any more than a pilot simulator is the same as really flying a plane. It's darn close. Or maybe even playing a race car driving game on the Xbox or PlayStation. It'll teach you a lot of the concepts of how to drift, etc. But it's not obviously the same as driving the race car. But I think there is a big benefit of practicing. But even the wet lab, to go in the wet lab and say, I'm going to throw 500 sutures with 10-0 nylon. I'm going to get a little tomato or a grape. I'm going to cut it, and I'm going to sit that under the microscope, and I'm going to keep sewing that together until I can suture beautifully. And the key with practice is, like in basketball, it's not did you go practice free throws for an hour. It's can you sink 9 out of 10 every time? And so it's putting in the hours to do that. The third point, which I think is very important, is you want to learn a little bit of something from every consultant or professor with whom you operate. They may do a different technique. Maybe it's something you don't normally do. Maybe they specialize in strabismus or oculoplastics. But there's something to learn from every one of them. And initially, early in your training, you're going to emulate other surgeons that have taught you. Maybe you'll amalgamate different techniques from multiple surgeons. And then eventually, with more experience, you'll come up with your own techniques or your own approach for doing this. So I think learning a little bit from every one of your senior surgeons is super important, even if it's not exactly in your field. The fourth thing is really important, and I live this every day, is learn from every case. you have to record your surgeries. If you have a video system in the operating theater and you're not using it, that's a shame. You have to record every case. Professional athletes, they always record themselves and watch game day footage to learn. You have to do the same thing. Understand that you're going to evolve your techniques. The way you do surgery today is for sure going to be very different than the way you do it in 10 years. Because your techniques will evolve. Procedures will evolve. Just look at what we're doing now. If I stopped evolving when I finished training, well, there was no lamellar corneal transplantation. There was no cross-linking. There were no femtosecond lasers. There were no trifocal IOLs. Even on the retina side, there were no anti-VEGF agents. Things obviously keep changing. The only constant in ophthalmology is change. So you need to be able to evolve your techniques and push yourself to keep learning. Don't be that guy who still operates the same way that you learned in training 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. That doesn't make sense. So always learn new techniques, keep evolving, and learn from every single case. And then the last and most important point, number five, is you want the real success to surgery and to being very successful in your future practice? You learned it when you were 5 years old. It was called the golden rule. You do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You give the patients the same high level of care that you'd want for your own eyes or your family's eyes. And by treating patients like family, you hold yourself to a higher standard. If that's going to be my brother's surgery tomorrow, I'm going to prepare a ton tonight. I need to know what I'm doing there. I need to figure out how to get this DMET graft unrolled and what percent SF6 should I mix with the air to get the best air bubble, I will learn all this. So by treating patients like family, it gives the patients the best outcome. It gives you the correct motivation to deliver your best. And the word of mouth you create will make you into a very busy and very successful surgeon. So those are my five things. One, prepare. Two is practice. Three, learn from everyone. Four, learn from every case and keep evolving. And number five, treat patients like family.
Yeah, I really loved all those tips. And I thought, you know, especially what you said about the surgical simulation and preparation was really interesting. Because I think in the UK, we had a recent paper which actually found a similar finding that the use of the IC surgical simulator resulted in a reduced posterior capsular rupture rate when it was used by trainees. So I think that's really interesting. Is surgical simulation and training quite common in the States? Or is it just in your center?
It's becoming more and more popular. I think it's gaining traction throughout the U.S. The U.S. is very large. We have a total of more than 100 ophthalmology residency training programs. And so our residents are basically your registrars. And the total number of people who start is about 450 per year. So it's obviously a big setup. And I'd say about half the programs or more have access to the surgical simulators. And I think it does make a difference. I think it's also a natural fit for the younger generation who grew up playing video games. It's a normal thing. And so the hand-eye coordination, the ability to look at a screen or through a microscope and not see your hands and let your hands do all the work, that's what you've been doing since you were a kid playing video games. It's the same thing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for the interest of some of the trainees in the UK, I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about the training for cataract surgeons or residents in the States. Like how long is the training for and how many cataracts do they do by the end of their 3-year training program? And what kind of training program do you teach people for learning how to perform cataract surgery?
Great question. So in the US, the typical training is 4 years of what we call college or you'd call university, where the people earn a bachelor's degree, then 4 years of medical school, finishing in the MD degree, then 1 year of an internship in general medicine or general surgery, then 3 more of ophthalmology residency, and that's where I specialize in teaching the doctors, and then you can go on or do 1 or 2 more years of a subspecialty fellowship. So during the 3-year training program at UCLA, which is among the largest in the country, we take 8 doctors per year, and that's a very large program. And our residents work very hard. So the number of procedures they do is actually very high, especially compared to other US programs. And part of the reason why, Los Angeles, where we say LA, is a very large city, huge. Number two in the US behind New York. So Los Angeles is bigger than Chicago. Chicago has 7 or 8 residency training programs, 7 or 8 medical schools. Los Angeles has two medical schools, 2 residency training programs. And I don't know exactly why that is, but that's how it's worked out. New York will have more than 10, maybe even a dozen. As a result, in Los Angeles, all of the county-type hospitals or public hospitals are staffed by residents who now basically do a huge volume. So in the U.S., a very typical ophthalmology residency training program may give the doctor 100 to 150 cataracts during the course of those 3 years of training. In our program at UCLA, it's very, very routine for us, our residents, to do 300 cases. They'll also do a huge number of diabetic procedures, retina procedures. Our residents will do 30, 40, 50 intravitreal injections in a day, 20 or 30 diabetic lasers in one day. And then for cataracts, the most we'd end up doing for each resident would be about 10 cases in one day. Now, we have the surgical experience more towards the senior residents. So of the 3 years of residency, in your first year, you'll do very few surgeries, less than 10. Your second year, somewhere 30 to 50. And then in your third year, you'll do 250 to 300 surgeries more.
Well, okay. I mean, I suppose there's some similarities there to the UK-based training. I think in the UK, in the first 2 years, you know, you do have a hands-on approach. You do develop your surgical skills, but it's more in the senior years where you really start to ramp up your numbers in terms of your cataract numbers and your surgical skills. So that's really, really interesting. How long have you been training residents?
I've been doing it for 20 years since I finished my training. I finished my training in the year 2000 and ever since then. And I teach the full spectrum. While my private clinic in Los Angeles, so I have a private surgery center in Beverly Hills, I specialize in cataract and refractive, probably 80% cataract, 20% refractive. When I'm with my doctors in training at the county hospital, the teaching hospital, we do everything. I'll do DSEC and DMEC with them. We'll do glaucoma valves for neovascular glaucoma. We'll do full thickness cornea transplants. Every part of the eye we will do. And so it's very good for me because it really keeps my skills up. I have to be able to attend them or supervise them for the full spectrum of ophthalmology. So it's a very neat program for them because they get to do all of these things hands-on.
Well, so, you know, 20 years of experience in supervising trainees, that's huge. So, you know, going on to the other side of the coin, you know, you've given us your tips for the junior cataract surgeons, but how about, would you say you have any tips for consultants who are training junior surgeons?
That's a great question. And so I think probably my best tip there is, at the beginning when you're working with a new doctor in training, keep the leash or the tether relatively short, meaning I'll scrub in every case when they're early in their training. And I'm sitting next to them looking through the assistant scope, and I'm very capable of taking over or even holding their hands to make sure the case goes as intended. So looking out for the patient and the patient's safety first. As they get more and more experience, I learn to give a little bit longer tether, a little bit longer leash, if you will, and let them operate without so much of my hands-on intervention. But at the beginning, we all know from doing cataract surgery in particular, it's very unforgiving. A terrible incision that's made, the rest of the case is difficult. It's going to leak now. You're going to get iris prolapse, chamber instability, more likely for the capsule to break. I mean, the whole, just from a bad incision. Or you do the surgery, you break the capsule. Well, you can't fix it. You can't undo it. And so even if the patient, you clean up everything, the patient looks like they have a reasonable outcome, you got to know in your heart that patient now has 10 times the endophthalmitis risk, 10 times the cystoid macular edema risk, all because of that. So keep the leash or the tether relatively short initially, and then as the doctor in training gets more and more experience, you know, give a little more slack to that, a little bit more leeway for them to learn. The other thing is to make sure we're teaching all the techniques. I don't want my residents to only graduate learning, let's say, just divide and conquer. You should be able to do stop and chop. In fact, you should be able to do horizontal chop, vertical chop, whatever it is. And so I want to make sure that they're going to learn all of these techniques. And then the last thing is you got to be a little different with the millennial generation. It's a little bit of different approach. And for me, that's one of the challenges, is to be able to interact with millennials and motivate them without being too harsh. I think we may have done our whole generation a disservice by doing all these participation trophies when they were young. But now I think the key is trying to find the right motivation in order to get them motivated and enthusiastic about learning surgery.
Sure. That's great. Thank you so much. So, you know, just before we finish, I've actually had a few questions written in to Eye to Eye to ask you your advice on a few things, if that's okay.
Of course.
So firstly, these are all anonymous, by the way. So the first question is, how do you feel about drinking coffee before you operate?
Oh, interesting question. So it's a personal preference. Some people can drink coffee and operate just fine. I almost never drink coffee before operating. On occasion, I'll have a coffee on the weekend, but before operating, I don't like it.
So you're not a massive caffeine fan then?
It doesn't do a whole lot for me. I'm very particular. Surgeons, we get to make these, we get into these routines and these superstitions. I won't even have a sip of wine or alcohol the night before I operate, not a sip. Because I can just tell me, I'm not quite my perfect A game. And so the night before surgeries, I sleep early. I wake up very early. I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I like to start at the first surgeries at 6:30 at the latest. So I start very, very early. And I just find that that's my best time to operate. I don't particularly enjoy operating in the afternoons on my own cases. So in my private clinic, I only schedule them for morning surgeries. Because I know for me, I'm the best in the morning. And so I schedule very early, 6 a.m. to maybe noon or 1 p.m. That's it. That's enough for me.
Sure. I mean, so you mentioned some superstitions there about, you know, timing, sleeping early, these kind of things. What about eating and drinking or any other particular superstitions or routines or, you know, mantras that you go through yourself before operating?
I think the bottom line is I just want to be able to give my best performance to every patient. Hmm. Every patient I do, right, we're going to leave our signature of a beautiful incision, a beautiful rexus, and a nicely centered lens. Those three things every ophthalmologist will see 10, 20, 30 years after your surgery. So I want to make these things in particular just beautiful. I want to give a great outcome to every patient, take pride in what I'm doing. And I know for me, that means I need to sleep early. I need to abstain from too much excitement the day before. No alcohol, nothing like that. And the morning of surgery for me, it also means I need to start early because that's when I'm the best. And I, in general, avoid the caffeine.
Sure.
But I take it very seriously. Yeah. I really want every patient to get my very best.
Yeah, I think we should all live by that. And I think generally we do, I would like to think. So the next question would be, I'll quote this one. So Dr. Devgan, I've noticed that you operate with your phacopro bevel down. I've always been taught that I should operate with my bevel up so I can see the tip of my phaco probe. Could you explain some of the reasons or rationale behind that, please?
For sure. So bevel up typically would be great for doing a sculpting a groove in the center of the nucleus, like for a divide and conquer. And so you can see how and where you're sculpting. But if you watch my videos when I'm operating, I'm a big fan of chop, phaco chop. And the idea in chop is you need to hold on to the nucleus with the phaco probe while the chopper does the chopping. In order to achieve that high vacuum pressure in the phaco tip, you have to occlude it. Remember, it's a peristaltic pump. It's not a Venturi pump on most phaco machines. So if you get that drinking straw and put it in your mouth, you can't build up a high pressure in that tube until you occlude the tip with your finger. Now you can build up such a high vacuum that you can fully collapse the straw. Well, similarly, when you're doing the phaco chop maneuver, I need to occlude the phaco tip. So if I go bevel down, just think about how easy it is to occlude that tip. I can barely buzz in the nucleus, it's already occluded. If I go bevel up, I have to really dig the phaco probe needle tip deep in the nucleus just to occlude it. And that's the reasoning behind that. But whatever makes you happy, bevel up, bevel down, it really doesn't make a difference.
Sure. So final question here is, I'll quote, so Dr. Devgan, should I perform my main incision with or without viscoelastic in the eye first?
Again, surgeon preference. If you've seen my videos, my preference is to have the viscoelastic in the eye. Some advanced surgeons do it without viscoelastic, but keep in mind with that 2.75 millimeter incision, if you distort it at all, you'll instantly collapse the anterior chamber. It's less forgiving. You need to go in and out nice and quickly, nice and clean, whether if the AC is just full of aqueous. If it's full of viscoelastic, it's okay. It slows things down. You won't get the collapse of the anterior chamber. So I think in your training, it's a lot easier to make the phaco incision while the anterior chamber is full of viscoelastic. And I still do that technique now after 20,000 cataracts.
I mean, that makes sense. I wouldn't imagine there's any disadvantage of doing that, is there?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a good idea. I think another very good move that you'll see me do on almost all my surgeries is after hydrodissection, but before putting the phaco probe in the eye, I'll put an additional aliquot of dispersive viscoelastic to recoat the central endothelium. Often during hydrodissection, we'll lose some viscoelastic from the AC. And this gives me a little bit more protection of those central endothelial cells. Because remember, my goal is beautiful vision the very next morning. In fact, in my private clinic, on post-op day one is when they sign the consent for surgery of the second eye, in most cases.
Rudé, thank you so much for your time, especially during this difficult period. We're all really looking forward to seeing you next year. Now for some interviews with abstract authors.
I'm talking with Chris Way, a Foundation Year 1 doctor who works at the Musgrove Park Hospital in Taunton. He's talking to me about his abstract, Technician-Assisted Glaucoma Virtual Review and Triage, the Eradication of a Glaucoma Pending List in a Large District General Hospital. Chris, thanks a lot for speaking with me today. I found your abstract really interesting. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your work?
Yeah, thanks, Sunil. So just as a bit of background, we know that outpatient specialties, particularly ophthalmology, are breaking under the sheer weight of referrals. And we know that glaucoma, particularly as a specialty, is going to have an increased amount of referrals in the next few decades. So by 2018, we thought that about 5,000 patients were waiting to be seen by a glaucoma team at Musgrove. So in November 2018, the whole team had a meeting to try and work out whether there was any way that we could better stratify patients who are high risk, medium risk and low risk and try and get people seen by the appropriate consultants at that time. And so what we did, we developed a series of pathways with which we could assess people according to their risk of glaucomatous field loss, and we put them in the right clinic. And the result of it is, as of June 2019, we were successful in able to eliminate the glaucoma waiting list here in the Southwest, which is great.
That's amazing news. Could you maybe share some specific details about how you ran your virtual clinic and maybe what equipment you used for it?
Obviously, we still have the consultants, and the consultants, hopefully, were seeing the more high-risk patients. But sort of in between that, we had these ShareClaire clinics where we had a nurse who was performing a questionnaire that had been predetermined as part of this team meeting, looking at things like compliance, any side effects, any issues that any of our patients were having. And then we also had a technician who was able to perform intraocular pressure measurements. And then taking all of that information, that data was set aside and given to a glaucoma consultant who had allocated time to determine whether this patient was high risk, medium risk and low risk, and then to distribute the patient accordingly.
And did your department need to purchase any new equipment to support this new idea?
Yeah, so at the start, we only had one OCT machine that we could use for glaucoma, and we found that that was a real bottleneck in terms of getting patients through the pathway. So what we did, we had a successful business case, actually, that we submitted to the trust, and that resulted in the purchasing of two more OCT machines. And we found that actually with that increased capacity within our department, that really helped us eliminate this waiting list.
So you mentioned before that in your virtual clinics, technicians were measuring the intraocular pressure. I'm just curious about what technique they used to perform that measurement.
Yeah, so we got a band 4 or a band 5 to use iCare to measure intraocular pressure. Now, we know iCare is not perfect. It's not quite as good as Goldman, which we know is the gold standard. But we thought that In these circumstances, this should be enough because these are the patients that we think are mild risk of glaucomatous field loss. And we have to remember that the whole point of our pathway is to stratify patients according to whether they are high risk or low risk.
Did you have any feedback from patients as to how they felt about being seen virtually by a technician rather than being seen by a consultant?
Yeah, so overall, anecdotally, the patients seem to really, really like it. I think the technicians and the nurses, they had a lot more time to spend with the patient rather than the glaucoma consultants who may have had a little bit bigger, heavier lists. It would have been nice to quantify it in the form of a questionnaire, but obviously at the time that we were looking about doing this, the COVID crisis struck, so all outpatient specialties really got hit by that. So it's something that we're going to look to do in the future.
Sure, and just one final question, really. I was wondering if you might have any key points or lessons learned that might be useful for other units to know.
The success that we had is that we used the pathway as a triage system and not being afraid to use it as such. We tried to get everyone on the same page with regards to protocols, so having these predefined agreed protocols that were robust we found was really, really important. So we know that glaucoma consultants are less risk averse in terms of extending their follow-up with glaucoma patients, and we implemented that into our protocols. Similarly, we were able to discharge those who didn't need our services, so we used a community ocular hypertension scheme. We found it was a safe place to discharge patients back to the community if they were found to not have glaucoma in the first place. And then finally, from a workforce point of view, we were able to upskill practitioners. So we know that there were glaucoma modules run at Aston University that thankfully our trust very kindly paid for these modules for these staff to do. These staff were able to assess stable patients.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Sunil.
I'm now speaking with Mr. Nicholas Maycock, a consultant ophthalmologist who works at the Queen Alexandra Hospital in Portsmouth. We're speaking about his paper, Real-World Clinical Effectiveness and Safety of Cyclosporine Eyedrop Emulsion in Patients with Dry Eye Disease and Severe Keratitis, the Perspective Study 24-Week Interim Analysis. Nick, thank you very much for joining me today to talk about your work. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your study?
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. It's a pleasure. I'm going to talk to you today about the 24-week interim analysis for the Perspective Study, which was a 12-month European multi-centre phase 4 real-world study using cyclosporine topical eye drops in the treatment of dry eye disease and severe keratitis. It was carried out across 5 European countries, Finland, Germany, Norway, Sweden and the UK, and across 29 clinical sites. We looked at, the primary study endpoint was the change in corneal fluorescein staining from baseline to 12 months. What we found in essence is that the cyclosporine drops were effective, they were well tolerated, and week 24 there was a significant reduction in corneal fluorescein staining and a significant improvement in objective and subjective measurements of dry eye disease.
That's really interesting. Could you tell us a bit more about the results and those subjective and objective measurements?
It showed an improvement in foreign body, burning, stinging, eye pain, photophobia, all the sort of classic symptoms that you get with dry disease. And it also showed a significant improvement in clinical signs as well. So there was a dramatic reduction in corneal fluorescein staining at week 24 with an average reduction of 1.5 points on the Oxford grading scale, which is quite a significant improvement with, I think, in the region of 77% to 78% of patients reporting a significant improvement.
You mentioned previously that you used this drug in the study in patients with dry eye disease and severe keratitis. How did you define severe keratitis?
We used the JEWS2 diagnostic criteria to first of all diagnose patients with dry eye disease. There's a nice diagnostic algorithm on the JEWS2 report, which starts off with a series of triaging questions, then looking at risk factor analysis, and then going through symptomology and measuring things like corneal fluorescein staining, tear breakup time. And it gives you an overall picture to work out whether the disease is evaporative, aqueous deficient. And for this particular study, we used a combination of that and then the corneal fluorescein staining via the Oxford grading system. So patients had to have at least 3 to 4 on the Oxford grading system before they're included in the study.
In your clinical practice, when you have a patient with dry eye disease, how do you determine whether or not they may be suitable for a treatment with cyclosporin?
First of all, I would go through the Jews 2 algorithm, work out what the cause of their dry eye disease was. And there is a sort of a stepwise progression in terms of treatment of dry eyes. So they would already be on sort of a combination of artificial tears or lubricant drops, possibly doxycycline or other suitable antibiotics. And it's a combination of, because with the dry eye disease, it's not only just a dry surface, but you get the ocular surface inflammation. And so it's trying to break that sort of feedback loop that you get. And so I would first of all start patients on a topical treatment, like a lubricant drop. If they're then still very symptomatic, they're getting problems and they've got the ocular surface inflammation, I would then consider starting them on a anti-inflammatory agent such as cyclosporin.
Just one final question now, if that's okay.
Sure.
In your study, were there any adverse events which may be associated with systemic absorption of cyclosporin?
In the study, we had one adverse event was reported, one serious adverse event, a patient with a thyroid disorder. Now, we're uncertain as to whether this was attributable definitely to taking topical cyclosporin, we're aware of it and it's under further investigation. What we do know is that the amount of cyclosporin that's actually absorbed systemically is negligible, because we're just using a 0.1% topical administration sort of onto the ocular surface.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
That's the end of our third episode of Content from College Congress. There'll be more to come later as the week goes by. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.